Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. On the show today, we're talking books. We'll be talking about a couple of new biographical reads, but before we get to those, we have another non-fiction that's just been released in paperback format and proves to be, well, a rather timely read in light of the inauguration week in the United States. In the studio, I'm joined by John Mitchinson, co-founder of Unbound Publishing. John, hello. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. Well, it's been a tale of tumult in the US, politically speaking at least. America gets a new president this week, and we'll start with a book that, well, I don't know, would you say everyone should read, maybe to make a little sense of some of the madness?
Yeah, I think you kind of look at America, and it's the whole thing, from the outside at least, has been pretty baffling. You can't quite see how a billionaire whose life has been about gambling and property development, can somehow seem to become the kind of the poster boy for American working class sort of values. It just seems
he's anti-elite, don't you know, John?
it's so mad. And the thing about him, you know, the bling, sitting there in his gold plated living room.
So just to be clear, your living room doesn't look like that.
No, my sadly doesn't. You know, I'm sure given an infinite budget. But so there's a sort of, I think from the outside there is this weird, something has happened. This does not, I think a lot of the pundits will keep saying, this is not normal. Mm. We can't look on Trump as a normal president. So I was at a soiree recently, and I was talking to no less than Peter York, the great, the great kind of semiotician, the man who brought us the Sloan Ranger handbook.
A good friend of ours here at Monocle.
Indeed. Yeah. And I said, Peter, you know, what's your take? And he said, Trump is just a front. He's a front. He said, the book to read is Dark Money. Read Dark Money. That's. So I thought, well, I'd sort of heard of it. It's written, Dark Money is written by Jane Mayer, who's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and I was vaguely aware I'd read a couple of things about it. But so I picked it up, and indeed, I think it is kind of, if you want to understand the right, what's happened in America is a right-wing revolution, and it's been funded by billionaires, not particularly by Trump, but the subject of the book, the main subject of the book are these rather kind of, I think you have to say slightly sinister brothers called the Koch brothers. They are, between them, I think they own the second largest or wealthiest private corporation in America. And really, for the last 30 years, they've used their money to fund across a broad range of activities, extreme right-wing, anti-statist kind of organizations. What they really hate is government. And the story is, in the great traditions of sort of business books that become like thrillers, Barbarians of the Gate, you know, all of the Michael Lewis books, Liar's Poker, Dark Money is their story and the story of a whole movement. Their father made his fortune by building oil refineries for Stalin and then setting up an organization in Germany, a company in Germany that made the fuel for the Luftwaffe during the war. He was a Nazi. He employed his sons. They had a Nazi nanny. They both, when they grew up, they became members of the John Birch Society. Very right wing, extremely right wing, and pretty racist sort of American society. So it's, and I guess extreme libertarianism would be what you'd describe it as. But it's really what Jane Mayer does in this book, I think, which is she's such a great journalist. She gets to the bottom of their story. She takes it from just being, you know, endowing university chairs and funding think tanks to actually becoming politically powerful. I mean, they funded the organizations that came to be known as the Tea Party. And it's out of this that sort of right-wing populists like Sarah Palin and then obviously Trump himself kind of emerges as a sort of viable. I mean, it's like they changed the tenor of American public life. And it is one of the most extraordinary, if you think about it, just stepping back, you know, the assault on liberalism, the kind of relentless assault on liberalism, to be able to get what they want is they don't want government because they want to be able to pollute. They've undermined climate change. They've undermined all of the sort of the tenets of what you might call liberal democracy. Jane Mayer's thesis in the book is that America is kind of dangerously out of control really now. It's no longer democratic.
Well, and that's not a narrative that she'd be alone in describing. I guess then in that sense, it's very instructive about how we got to here.
Yeah.
What about if you're slightly fearful, perhaps I am, John.
Yeah.
And you thought, well, what about looking forwards? You know, does this book offer me any solace about what could be?
That's my only. In a way, it's a bit mean to be critical of a journalist because she's doing a job. She's telling a story. You know, you end this book feeling more depressed than when you picked it up, let's be brutally honest.
So really, this is the perfect week to read it.
I'm guessing what you have to recognise is that the combination of money and strategy, when you look at, you know, the rise of what we're dealing with fake news and Breitbart, and then the good thing about it is at least this book exists. And as various people have pointed out, it's fascinating the Koch brothers haven't tried to sue.
Mm.
Because basically, I think they did spend quite a bit of money trying digging into her past to see if there are any skeletons, but obviously there were none.
They probably had that conversation and went, look, we're back to rights, let's just leave it.
Well, you know, they're kind of, their guy's about to take over, right?
So,
I mean, I guess from the point of view of what do we do next, you have to say, well, the institutions, the checks and balances that people talk about that are there, legal recourse, you know, part of the problem is funding. You know, the caps on funding were all removed, so that it's very, very difficult now to see without there being a down the road, a kind of that maybe this won't work economically. I think everybody is waiting. How can it possibly be that, as you know, American taxpayers, the poorest are being taxed more, their healthcare is being reduced, and the billionaires are not? Sort of feel at some point somebody's going to wake up, the mass of America are going to wake up and say, hang on, this is self-interest. But we'll see. It's really, it's hard to be positive.
No,
this book will not help you be more, but it will make you better informed.
Well, there you go. So get the information at least. Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right by Jane Meyer is out now. It's published by Doubleday Books. Well worth a read, but you might need a stiff drink before, during and after. Well, as well you might with this one. Our second book today is Moonglow, the latest by Pulitzer Prize winning author Michael Chabon. The chronicles the narrator's discussions with his family, particularly his dying grandfather. John, what is this book? It sort of teeters somewhere between novel, memoir. What do you make of it?
He kind of says, you know, this is more or less the truth, but except where the truth didn't fit into the what I wanted it to be. Chabon he loves doing this. I mean, Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, the book of his that won the textbook. He likes to inhabit the real world and then to fictionalize it. So I don't know how much of this is actually true about his actual grandfather. Mike Chabon is the narrator. He's a novelist. There's some marvelous sort of fun and games with his grandfather. Grandfather basically is dying of cancer, and then decides he's going to unburden it all. And there's various points he's saying, you know, you can make all sense of it, kid. You know, I'm just giving you a mishmash, and you can. I loved it. I have to say, I love Chabon's work anyway. I don't think there's a writer anywhere who can tread this extraordinary line between comedy and high seriousness. He's remarkable. He can do that in a space of a few characters. He's brilliant at character sketches. The story, I mean, without giving too much of away, is really his grandfather's story and the story of the love between his grandfather and his grandmother. She was a French woman, and they met during the war. I think for Chabon, in interviews, he said that the Second World War has influenced absolutely everything. Those 6 years are the prism, really, through which the rest of the 20th century, and even into the 21st century, everything changed. So these two characters, their romance. His grandfather, it turns out, was a soldier, obviously, but he'd been put in behind the lines. He was also obsessed with space travel. He was put in behind enemy lines in Germany to try and bring the rocket scientists back. So there's an immense amount of detail about the space program, about the whole idea of rockets, the idea of a rocket as being something beautiful and technological that is breaking the bonds of gravity, you know, so that kind of the idealism that's behind. And then the discovery that, of course, Wernher von Braun, the great rocket scientist who invented the V2 and went on to invent in the US the Saturn V rocket, the narrator, the grandfather, witnesses the horror of the slave labor that is being used in the rocket program. And this changes his life and sort of slightly sours his relationship with space travel generally. It's a marvelous kind of rollicking history of post-war American life. It's sort of set, as he said, he's having these reveries drugged out of his brain on his deathbed, and the novelist is piecing them all together. Like all of Chabon's novels, I think it's a high wire act. This is the most fun I think I've had with Siobhan since Cavalier and Clay. I recommend it very highly.
High praise indeed. Moonglow by Michael Siobhan is published by Fourth Estate. Check it out, I think, is the verdict from here. Finally, let's go back significantly further in time for Young and Damned and Fair. This is the story of Henry VIII's fifth wife, Catherine Howard, famously one of the six, who came to a rather grisly demise. Well, very grisly, it wasn't rather. After a scandal involving her, several men from her past and present, a short life, executed aged only 18 or 19, which certainly you sometimes forget. This book by the author and historian Gareth Russell attempts to lift the lid on what Catherine Howard was like and, this great scandal, one of many of Henry VIII's reign. John, it's interesting. Parts of this story are very well told, maybe others less so. How does Gareth Russell set about telling the tale?
Well, he's... First of all, some historians are good at the detail and some are good at the narrative. He seems to me to have almost the perfect balance. He picks a moment, I guess, a short period. Often Catherine Howard's just kind of glanced over because she's almost at the end, but not quite. And she is one of the ones that is beheaded rather than just died or divorced. And what he does is he takes her life as a sort of a prism through which to look at the whole of what's happening in Tudor society. And he does that, I think, utterly brilliantly. It's full of the smells and the food and the madness. I mean, at the middle of it all is this really grotesque kind of portrait of Henry himself, who is vast by this stage. And he's got a 50-inch waist and he's got a gangrenous kind of thing, an ulcer on his leg that stinks. And I think he restores Catherine as a character. It's full of maps and genealogies. There's a huge weight of scholarship behind it. But the story that he tells is, in a way, it is a terrible, sad and sordid story. But he does it in such a way that she does retain or regain perhaps some of the dignity. She's always written off as a tart and a chancer. And indeed, she was perhaps both of those things. But the book is better than that. The book makes you see that in some ways she didn't really have much choice. She certainly made a terrible error when she started an affair with Nicholas Culpepper, who was not a particularly attractive character. I mean, he was young and he was handsome. He was everything the king wasn't. But, I mean, she paid for that with her life. And I think you get this sort of sense of, you know, she was sort of groomed from an early age. I mean, one of the things I think some of the critics who've liked the book less perhaps than I did have pointed out that, you know, it was essentially abuse. It's just very difficult at 600 years distance to sort of see. You can have the human sympathy for the character. I mean, who knows what was. But yeah, I think somebody said she's fondled at 13, lost her virginity at 14 and was, you know, being bedded by the king at 17. And then within 16 months of her, of her accession, she was killed, beheaded.
And John, do you think, is it partly about the fact that we paint this picture of her? I mean, you know, even her background was interesting. It was sort of aristocratic in part, but not entirely blue-blooded. There was, within some of her immediate family, there not always great wealth everywhere. Or is it more of a historian's tale where, you know, Russell has unearthed some compelling additional detail? What drives it for you?
I guess that what drove it for me, just on a very simple level, is it picks up the story pretty much at the end of when Thomas Cromwell is, and, you know, I was a huge fan of Wolf Hall and Bringing Up the Bodies, and this book flows on neatly. It's the next big phase in Henry's life, and I guess the thing for me was that I suppose the juxtaposition of you have a king who is now all powerful, and he's put, you know, the execution of Cromwell, which is pretty sordid, is shortly followed by him discovering this extraordinarily kind of, the king is obviously going off Anne of Cleves, decided she, the Flanders mare, she's not delivering on any level. And then this young, pert, kind of quite, I mean, it's a brilliant portrait. What he does in the book, I think, is so well, is he sets the scenes perfectly. You know, you can, as I say, you know, the clothing, every historical detail. He assumes she's a virgin because she looks virginal. She's not. When it all kind of unravels for her. I suppose that's the thing. It's like a it is a little bit like, you know, it's a sort of like a domestic noir. You know that the female character has got a past, and you know that he isn't going to be able to deal with it. And you're even though you know what's going to happen because you know the history, you're kind of rooting for her to get away with it because she has energy and charm and she's smart. As you say, her background was noble enough, but she had a lot of enemies at court as well. And it's, I guess, there's something about that court that is the intrigue, the people jostling for power, you know, Norfolk in the back, these sinister kind of people who are always trying to and the king... You know, the king who's not a fool, but he is vain and he is obviously still completely by this stage obsessed with, you know, and it's pretty clear from the book. He's very good in the book about it not being, the marriage was probably never consummated. I mean, he was unable to perform. But she obviously knew what she was doing. And there's some really extraordinary things. The marriage vow that she had to say. I mean, just madness. You think about royalty today was to be bonny and buxom in bed and at board.
Is that not the same as the contemporary ones? John, thanks very much for being with us, as always.
You,
that's John Mitchinson. You've been listening to the Monocle Arch Review with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher. The show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll be talking films. But for now, thank you for listening and goodbye.